Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we celebrate American cuisine with some of our country's experts. We begin with Gabrielle Langholz, author of America, the Cookbook.
Ultimately, you know, the book says, what is American food? Ask that question, which is kind of the question, who is American? And we're a really big, diverse country, and we have a really big, diverse menu that reflects that.
Then, Adrian Miller shares stories of the African-American men and women who fed our first families, from George Washington to Barack Obama.
These African-Americans were culinary artists, family confidants, and at times civil rights advocates who gave our presidents a window on black life that they might not have otherwise had.
We're savoring the diversity that shapes America's food culture on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. United Airlines is informing 36,000 U.S.-based employees they may be out of a job after the 1st of October. That's the earliest airlines are allowed to lay off or furlough workers if the carriers claim payroll assistance under the Federal CARES Act. United says the number may end up being lower if more people take a buyout or retire early. Air travel has fallen dramatically since the start of the pandemic. A growing number of experts deeply entrenched in public health research warn the global outbreak could get worse in the coming months. Aware of the coronavirus data, the Trump administration is leaning on states to reopen schools in the fall. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports on Vice President Mike Pence's remarks today after Johns Hopkins University reported that the number of people who are or have been infected with coronavirus in the U.S. has surpassed 3 million.
Vice President Pence says resuming in-person instruction is absolutely essential. He also says the administration plans to work with governors and local school officials to craft reopening plans.
We're going to be looking for ways to give states a strong incentive and an encouragement to get kids back to school.
Pence announced the CDC will issue new guidelines for schools next week, shortly after President Trump took to Twitter to criticize the public health agency for asking schools to do, quote, very impractical things. Trump also threatened to withhold funding from school districts that don't reopen in the fall. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who encountered backlash for being a key witness in President Trump's impeachment inquiry, is retiring from the Army after 21 years of service. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has chosen to put the nation's interests ahead of his own, and that has cost him his career, says Vindman's attorney, David Pressman. Vindman was a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, and he emerged as a critical witness in the impeachment inquiry against President Trump. But after the Senate voted to acquit the president, Trump fired Vindman and others who had testified. Vindman's twin brother, who was a lawyer on the NSC, also lost his job. Vindman's lawyer says Trump and his allies have waged a campaign of bullying, intimidation, and retaliation against Vindman. The goal, Pressman says, has been to force Vindman to choose between following the law or pleasing the president. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Special Envoy on North Korea says the Trump administration wants further dialogue with North Korea, and NPR's Anthony Kuhn says Pyongyang does not.
Deputy Secretary of State Stephen Biegun tried to portray the Trump administration as open-minded and flexible. He said he's aware that Pyongyang isn't interested in talks and that he hadn't asked for any. Biegun also voiced support for cooperation between North and South Korea. Pyongyang underlined its lack of interest in that last month by blowing up an inter-Korean liaison office.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn. This is NPR. The top U.S. general for the Middle East is predicting an ongoing American military presence in Iraq, just smaller. Marine General Frank McKenzie met with the new Prime Minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, yesterday. McKenzie says he has the impression that Iraqis don't want U.S. troops to withdraw just yet, not when ISIS remains a major threat. At the start of the year, the U.S. assassinated a top Iranian general during an airstrike in Baghdad. Many Iraqis were infuriated and demanded U.S. forces leave. The head of Europe's largest economy is urging EU lawmakers to work together to overcome the financial carnage of the global coronavirus pandemic. Esme Nicholson reports German Chancellor Angela Merkel addressed delegations in Brussels ahead of what's expected to be tough negotiations over an EU recovery fund.
Angela Merkel said she was relieved to be back among real people as she addressed lawmakers in the European Parliament. Her trip to Brussels is her first foreign excursion since the start of the pandemic. She warned lawmakers they faced the EU's biggest challenge yet.
Allein kommt niemand durch diese Krise.
Nobody will make it through this crisis alone. We are all vulnerable. European solidarity isn't simply a human gesture, but a sustainable investment. Merkel must convince her European counterparts to agree to a €750 billion joint recovery fund, which then has to be ratified by the EU Parliament and then by all 27 national parliaments within the EU. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to raising the standard of trust online. Used by millions, they work to help people search privately and avoid trackers. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Did you miss your favorite KRVS program? Well, we've got you covered. Visit krvs.org, scroll over Audio on Demand, select your favorite program from the list, and find an archive of past episodes. Listen anytime, anywhere.
From Scotland, Ireland, North America, and even further afield, bask in the glow of my selection of more new music from Celtic roots. Join me again this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Summertime is chock full of holidays that celebrate America. From Memorial Day through the 4th of July and Labor Day, we're red, white, and blue through and through. On this week's show, we pay tribute to American food and drink with some of our country's experts. We begin with Gabrielle Langholz, author of America, the Cookbook. Gabrielle's encyclopedic tome explores our nation's identity through the immigrant stories and recipes that created American food as we know it. Then, Adrian Miller shares stories of the African-American men and women who fed our first families, from George Washington to Barack Obama. Finally, spirits expert Noah Rothbaum joins us. His book, The Art of American Whiskey, uncovers our country's history through 100 whiskey labels. We're savoring the diversity that shapes America's food and drink culture on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Gabrielle Langholz, and I'm the author of America, the Cookbook, a culinary road trip through the 50 states.
Foodways can reveal a lot about identity. And here in America, deeply embedded within our identities are the stories of migration. When Gabrielle set out to write her tremendous cookbook, she quickly realized that the history of American food belongs to the immigrants that found their home here. So Gabrielle traveled the country in search of these stories, and she doesn't mince words when she talks about the arduous research process.
Oh my gosh, It was a monster assignment. Well, I had met Emily Takutis, the executive editor at Fiden's New York office, and Emily thought of me because she knew me professionally a little bit and that I had done one cookbook about farmers markets, and I had been the editor-in-chief for Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn for 10 years, so at the Edible magazines and really celebrating place-based taste and thinking about the local foods movement and traditional foods in American communities. But what she didn't know was, as I like to say, I actually grew up in America. And I'm not kidding. I had been to every state before Emily reached out to me, actually with the one exception of Maine. So when I got this assignment, I immediately booked a week-long trip to Maine.
What was your reach out to find these recipes? And how did you narrow them down?
That was so much fun. My original assignment was to do only 500 recipes. I mean, only, of course, is kind of silly because that's a huge number, but we ended up clocking in closer to 800. So originally I set out to find about 10 recipes per state, and I was looking for the kind of quintessential iconic dishes that would represent every state. And I will tell you, Poppy Tooker, that in my very first meeting I said to her, I'm going to need to go way over 10 for California and Louisiana. Those were the two states that I was like, there's no way I can begin to tell this culinary story with just 10 recipes. And what I really set out to do with this book is really look beyond the kinds of Americana dishes that we all always think of. So things like roast chicken, fried chicken, mashed potatoes. I mean, I love those things, and they are in the book, and they belong in the book. But to really try to look past them to unusual regional specialties, immigrant dishes. Ultimately, you know, the book says, what is American food? Ask that question, which is kind of the question, who is American? And we're a really big, diverse country, and we have a really big, diverse menu that reflects that.
So we certainly are a nation of immigrants, and I'd like to know about some of the nations that were important culinary contributors for you. There's a dish called acida that originates in South Sudan, and you found it in Omaha?
Absolutely. There's a Sudanese refugee population in Nebraska, absolutely, and that's a dish made with millet flour. We also found some really interesting dishes with Sudanese greens with peanut sauce, and, you know, it's crazy, but with 750 recipes, we actually felt we were only scratching the surface. But we looked at everything from Middle Eastern foods around Detroit to Korean food in L.A. and New Jersey, to Vietnamese food down where you are, where so many people had moved to work in the shrimping industry, you know, Peruvian food. I mean, America is called melting pot for good reason, or some people call it more of a tossed salad because we don't just kind of melt completely together and become homogenous. We mix together but maintain some of our background and own identity. But, you know, Poppy, one thing that I had never thought about before in terms of immigrant identity and immigrant foods in America was that so many of the dishes that we think of as really quintessential Americana were brought here by immigrants over time. I mean, you look back, literally, chicken and pork and beef were all brought by the Spanish, and you know, the hamburger and the Frankfurter and beer are brought by the Germans, and people call something as American as apple pie, and apples, of course, are native to Afghanistan and brought here by European immigrants, and so was the butter and the wheat and the crust. Or you know, you think about even the things that you find on the kids' menu today, like spaghetti and meatballs and macaroni and cheese and pepperoni pizza, you know, brought here by Italian immigrants and really hardly known in the United States even as recently as 100 years ago. So when we talk today about going out for Korean food or Filipino food or Peruvian food, or Ecuadorian food, I mean, those certainly are immigrant foods, and they are just the most recent in a long line of dishes that people have been bringing to America for a long time. And, you know, I've got Native American foods in this book, too, and certainly corn is essential to the American diet still today, and tomatoes and hot peppers, and turkey and cranberries and salmon. So there are certainly foods that were here in 1491 that are still pillars of the American diet, but the vast, vast majority of the ingredients and dishes that we eat today were brought here by immigrants over time.
I mean, if for some reason America didn't exist one day, its food could be recreated from the pages of your book. To me, it was kind of like the joy of cooking for 21st century America. It really did feel like that sort of a standard that everybody would want on their bookshelf.
Oh, Poppy, thank you so much. Well, that's just what we were going for. And America has a mixed reputation culinarily, certainly, around the world and here at home. And I talk about this a little bit in the introduction, that for some people the phrase American cuisine is an oxymoron or can feel like a punchline. I mean, America earned a bad reputation for food that you buy through a car window or just add water. And I really wanted to come out with this book and say that is such a small part of the story. I mean, that is part of the story, and that's real. But there is so much true, deep regional cuisine that is alive and well. And this book is a love letter to that, and it means so much to me to hear you describe it that way.
I'm very curious. You know, one of the things that I know you hold near and dear to your heart, as well as I do with our long history with slow food.
Yep.
Did you find any food traditions along the way that you thought perhaps were endangered that you're helping save with the book?
I certainly hope so. Gosh, probably half the things in the book are regional specialties that that we could lose. But for the most part, Poppy, I really see an enormous new appetite for them. And I think that's new and growing. I mean, when I was a kid, I think for most of the 20th century, people didn't think of American food as a cuisine certainly as a cuisine to have in the setting of fine dining. But one of the things that I've really noticed is that there is a real growing appreciation and appetite for the ingredients and dishes that are foundational to regional American cuisine. And in fact, this is a thread that runs through many of the essays in the book. In the back of the book, we have an essay for each state by some of the greatest culinary minds in the country. And I was amazed by how many of them said a variation of the sentence, Scott Peacock's first sentence in his Alabama essay. He says, "When I left Alabama, I was never going back." And there are so many chefs who talk about growing up and thinking of fill-in-the-blank state or America as a country as a place to just leave behind with a one-way ticket. And everyone's like, I was going to Tuscany, or I was going to Tokyo, or I was going to the French Culinary Institute, and I was going to learn to cook real food. And only in recent years, I think partly through the farmers market movement, have people rediscovered something that's kind of been hidden in plain sight all this time. And now you'll see chefs like Sean Brock, you know, considered one of the very best chefs in the world, cooking new Southern food, cooking the food that he grew up with in South Virginia with his grandmother, doing like pickled watermelon rind and pimento cheese and things that would never have been on a tasting menu when I was growing up. Or you see books like Ronnie Lundy's book, Vittles, win the James Beard Award, or New Midwestern Table win the James Beard Award a few years ago. So I do see this wonderful rediscovery and celebration and valuing now of American food in a way that I'm excited about, and I see it growing.
Well, it's a perfect time for your book. And if you were to look into a crystal ball, what would you predict the future of American food to be?
Oh, great question. Well, you know, I was on a panel at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia, talking about American food, and someone in the audience asked this question. And Kevin West, who's my essayist for Tennessee, he had such a great answer. He said, kimchi tacos. And I just love that answer. I love kimchi tacos, but I just love that answer because it's about evolution. It's about immigrants bringing their dishes and influencing one another and kind of having love children together. Or Ed Lee, who's my chef for Kentucky, he makes a dish that's collard greens with kimchi. And, you know, he grew up in Brooklyn. He's got Korean-American heritage. And nobody ever put kimchi in collards before, but they are delicious and they belong there. So in answer to your question, I think kimchi tacos are the future of American food.
Gabrielle Langholz, author of America, the Cookbook. Come back from a short break, we'll hear stories about the African-American men and women who have fed our first families, from George Washington's time right through Barack Obama. When the self-described soul food scholar Adrian Miller joins us, stay tuned.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bill Bolins from the Dirty Rice Show. Dirty Rice is on the air every Saturday evening from 9 p.m. until 11 p.m. So won't you join either myself or my co-host, Mr. Lee Kleinpeter, for the best in Louisiana music, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krvs.org.
This week in This American Life.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
A car dealership in Long Island tries to sell its monthly quota of cars, 129 cars. It's not going well.
I want balloons in the showroom. I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Will it work? Find out this week.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group. Ralph's on the Park, located on City Park Avenue in Mid-City, is open for dinner with dine-in and balcony dining Tuesday through Sunday, with brunch served on weekends. Family-style dinner service for curbside pickup continues Wednesday through Sunday. To learn more, visit ralphsonthepark.com or reach them directly at 504-488-1000. And now, back to Louisiana Eats.
I'm Adrian Miller, the self-described soul food scholar. My tagline is dropping knowledge like hot biscuits. And I am the author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas.
The White House has always been one of America's most iconic symbols of freedom and democracy. Yet, since the days of our nation's first president, George Washington, the struggle for freedom has been quietly fought with food. Behind the scenes there, African-American cooks have influenced the president's palates and temperaments from behind the White House stoves. Adrian Miller gives us a glimpse into those kitchens and the food that changed America in his book, The President's Kitchen Cabinet. Adrian, I would like to start off by asking you how you came about the concept for this book and why you decided to write it.
Well, while I was researching my book on the history of soul food, I read a lot of old newspapers that had been digitized and made available online. And that was a treasure trove of information. And periodically, African Americans who had cooked for our presidents would jump off the page at me while I was reading these old newspapers. So I said, at some point, I got to see if there's enough information out there about these cooks so I can write a fuller story about them, because that's just a perspective on the presidency that we've never really heard before.
There never was a time without African-Americans in domestic work from Washington mm-hmm. through today there at the White House. How hard was it for you to uncover these folks? You get all their names in the book.
So it was difficult because, for several reasons, in a lot of sources, especially in the 19th century, they really wouldn't give the full names mm-hmm. of these people who worked in the White House, because why would you? The mm-hmm. social, you know, the times didn't call for respect for the full humanity of African Americans. So sometimes they would just say colored cook or Negro cook or servant, or they might give the first name or the last name. So I had to look at several sources just to piece together information. The other thing is there's a code of silence around working in the White House. So there aren't a lot of firsthand accounts of people in the White House telling their story. So I had to rely quite a bit on secondary sources just to kind of pull this all together. But it was really looking at presidential biographies, old newspapers, and other sources just to create that list.
Let's go back to Washington's time and discuss the role of the White House steward. And I suppose the first big name that comes up is Samuel Francis.
Yes.
Also known as Black Sam.
Yes, which is an interesting nickname for him to have. So Samuel Francis is picked as the first presidential steward. And what that means is he was in charge of all of the operations for the residence. So that meant he hired the chef, he oversaw the culinary operations, as well as the maids and the butlers. So it was a very important position. Today, the equivalent would be chief usher of the White House. Francis gets this title because Washington met him when he was a general, and he would go frequent Francis's tavern that was in the lower Manhattan in New York. Actually, there's a replica of that tavern that exists to this day. And Washington loved Francis's food and just the way he operated his business. And so he had a lot of trust in him, and then eventually picks him to run the residence. And one of Francis's first tasks is he hires a white woman to cook for Washington for the first 6 months. And evidently her food was nasty because Washington had her fired. And he tapped Hercules, who was the enslaved chef from Mount Vernon, to come work in this kitchen. And really from day one, the presidential kitchen has been a multiracial workforce. You've had enslaved African Americans working next to indentured whites, and sometimes free whites and free African Americans. And so Francis was in charge of all of that, and by all accounts, he did an excellent job. But he was a little too extravagant in his tastes, and he ultimately gets fired by Washington for putting the very best on his table much too often.
Well, of course, for a long time, right almost to Lincoln, there were slaves working in the White House. There were free
yes.
people of color. The slaves were sort of lived down in the basement.
Absolutely. And what is lost on a lot of people is that the White House kitchen was not a pleasant place to work because it was in the basement, as you said. But during the summer months, actually, sometimes the enslaved cooks would have to stay behind. Jefferson did that with the two enslaved women who worked for him, Edie Fawcett and Frances Hearn. And people would get tropical diseases. The workers in the White House would get tropical diseases like malaria and stuff because the White House is in a reclaimed swamp area. And it shows that a lot of African-American presidential chefs and cooks were accidental. They just happened to either be the longtime enslaved person for a president who decided to bring them to the White House, or they were a longtime family servant. There are very few examples of someone starting their career with the goal of working in the White House kitchen.
There were things I learned in the book that really made me cringe, things I hadn't really thought of before. And the fact that from Teddy Roosevelt right through Herbert Hoover, there was an Irish or a Swedish immigrant woman in the kitchen.
Yes.
Because during the Jim Crow era, it's so bizarre that that coincides with the great immigration of Irish and other Europeans who mm-hmm. then become the domestics for the elite. And once again, African Americans get figuratively sent to the back of the bus.
Yep. I was fascinated by that as well. I did not know that aspect of White House history. And you see this not only in the White House, but in other elite households around the country. And right around the time that Plessy v. Ferguson is enacted, 1896, right around that time, you see a backlash of having African Americans in service positions, not only in households, but also in restaurants, which is kind of counterintuitive to how we think of Jim Crow, because I thought the whole point was to have African Americans as kind of the servant class. So the fact that African Americans were getting pushed out of even those jobs was a big surprise to me. That string lasts for a long time. Actually, it goes through Herbert Hoover, and it wasn't until when Franklin Roosevelt comes in the White House that black cooks start to have a dominant role again.
Well, I was also fascinated that in the time before Air Force One, of course, the presidents traveled by train. Tell us about how that went with the presidents and how the first Pullman dining car actually was called the president.
Yes. There wasn't an official White House dining car that would travel with the president. So what would happen is when the president would go someplace, the railroad president would just lend them, the president, their own private dining car, which often had names like Presidente Coronado, you know, other things. And so along with that dining car would be the best chef for that railroad. And presidents had their favorite routes and trains that they would travel. So some of these railroad cooks got to know our presidents quite well. And I wrote about one cook who actually served President Garfield all the way to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and remembered kind of the favorite dishes of all those presidents, which I thought was amazing. Now, I do begin my book with a funny story about President Taft. And the interesting thing about him is he was taking a midnight train to Ohio. And after the train left the railroad station in Washington, D.C., he asked the conductor if there was a dining car attached, and there wasn't. So he made the train stop off in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and have a dining car attached so that he could grub on some mutton chops or some lamb chops at midnight.
Well, they had all rationalized that he'd had a good dinner and he'd have breakfast in the morning when he arrived, but they didn't count the midnight munchies with Taft.
They did not. And the only reason this happened, I'm convinced, is because the First Lady and the White House physician were not on the train. They couldn't enforce his diet.
Well, that has a lot to do with the whole story of the presidents and the cooks, because they all have wicked things that they're not supposed to eat that they've got to cajole the cook into sneaking to them almost.
Mm-hmm. And the cooks are caught in the middle because their ultimate boss is the president, but their immediate boss is often the First Lady. And the First Lady is often saying, don't give them that. And then you've got the president saying, I want that. So usually they wait till the First Lady's not around to hook them up. One other funny story, Daisy Bonner, how she would get around that is the physician or the First Lady would tell them what to make for the president. So they would make it, and they would bring it to him. And as they were setting it down, they would whisper in his ear, don't eat that. And so he would just play around with his food and fake like he's not hungry. And then once everybody had cleared out, they'd take him back in the kitchen and hook him up with what he really wanted.
Of course, then we had President Lyndon Baines Johnson. And his cook, Zephyr Wright, was very instrumental in helping the president end segregation in the United States. Mm-hmm. What did Zephyr Wright do for LBJ?
So Zephyr Wright, she's probably the most fascinating character in the book to me. And if there was any one cook that I want to meet, it would be her. She was a longtime cook for the Johnsons before he actually entered Congress. And as he rose in position in Congress, she would stay with the family in Washington and then go back with them to Texas. And they drove in those times. And in the rides to and fro from Texas, she would experience a lot of indignities because of Jim Crow. She couldn't go into restaurants. She couldn't go to the restroom at any time with the family. It got so bad that she said, I'm no longer taking that trip. So when Johnson becomes president and he's carrying on the civil rights legacy of the recently slain President Kennedy, as he lobbied for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, he would often use the anecdotes of Zephyr Wright's experiences to pressure congressmen to support that bill. Once it passed, he used one of the pens for signing the legislation. He gave it to Zephyr Wright and said, you deserve this as much as anyone.
Well, that says a mouthful. And God bless Zephyr Wright and the role that she played in changing America. And America changes with the presidents.
Yes. This book really shows that these African Americans were culinary artists, family confidants, and at times civil rights advocates who gave our presidents a window on black life that they might not have otherwise had.
Adrian, thank you so much for your inspiring work, and I hope to see you right here in New Orleans sometime soon.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears. But thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you, Adrian.
All right, peace.
Adrian Miller, author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of African Americans who have fed our first families. For spirits expert Noah Rothbaum, every bottle tells a story. Noah is the author of The Art of American Whiskey, which examines the artistry of old whiskey labels as symbols of American history at large. We spoke with Noah about the stories the labels tell, which brought us back to the days of Prohibition, when whiskey bottles were hidden throughout the clandestine bars of speakeasies. Noah, I'm so thrilled to be able to speak with you about your beautiful, beautiful book. And you point out that, you know, everybody's been paying so much attention to what goes in the bottle instead of the bottle itself, the packaging, the labels. Why does that interest you so much?
Well, I think that is part of the whole experience. You know, we're choosing whiskey or really any spirit, not just how it tastes, but also, you know, how the label is designed, how the bottle, how it's presented, you know, sort of like a cocktail. It's, you know, a holistic experience. You know, it's the glass, it's the garnish, it's the way that it's served. And for so long, rightly so, people have been appreciating wine labels and old cognac posters and even cigar bands. And it was one of these things that was sort of overlooked. And I saw a collection of old bottles and labels. I thought to myself, wow, these are amazing. This would make a great book. And then I thought, I should write the book. you know, the sort of light bulb went off. And, you know, the more I looked into it, the more I realized, you know, that I was really onto something. And some of the labels in the book have really not been seen in decades, you know, and if they've been seen, only by a select few people. So it was kind of part detective work, part treasure hunter. So it was kind of a fun experience.
Noah, would you talk to us a little bit about the six brands that were allowed to operate during Prohibition? I think a lot of people think that during Prohibition, all liquor went away and all that was left was some really nasty near beer.
Right.
But there were actually six brands. Who were they? And how did they get that privilege?
To be honest, you're right. I mean, the Prohibition chapter is one of my favorite sections to work on in the book because there's so much to learn. And I didn't think it would be that complex, you know, like because a lot of these questions I never really thought about before. But when you look into it, Prohibition sort of outlawed the manufacture and transportation sale of spirits. But the government allowed a number of brands to sell whiskey for medicinal uses. And they were labeled as medicinal whiskeys because, I mean, in 1870, the first bottle of whiskey is Old Forester. And Old Forester, you know, was targeted at doctors, not because doctors are great drinkers. Some of them obviously are. But it was because doctors prescribed alcohol as a cure-all for a range of maladies, right? So, and they wanted to make sure that what they were prescribing was pure because up until that point, you were never exactly sure what the whiskey had been cut with. So these brands were allowed to bottle medicinal whiskeys. And I kind of thought in my mind, are the bottles kind of look like rubbing alcohol? Like, you know, you go to the pharmacy today and you fill a prescription for, you know, an antibiotic. It just comes in a regular nondescript bottle. But in fact, the label art and bottle design, and a lot of them came in cardboard boxes, are absolutely beautiful and elegant. You know, one of them has like, it's called, I think, Royal Wedding, and it has like wedding bells embossed on the side. And obviously, I mean, we all know what was going on. Like, this wasn't for medicinal uses, but for people who were having a wedding, you know what I mean? And,
right.
And it's labeled, you know, and some of them have just as, you know, sometimes you see ads like 4 out of 5 doctors recommend, you know, some of them are like 4 pharmacists recommend this whiskey, you know, it's kind of amazing. And there's one of my favorite labels is one from Four Roses from a pharmacy in Sparks, Nevada, and it has the pharmacy label on it. And the directions are clear still that tell you how that you're supposed to take it.
Like, and as if how's that?
I think it was 2 ounces of whiskey mixed with 1 ounce of hot water. So essentially a hot toddy, which obviously is still a great cure-all for whatever ails you.
All right.
So it's kind of, it was amazing. I mean, it sort of opened my eyes. And in fact, so much medicinal whiskey was sold that the government had to declare a distiller's holiday where they were allowed to make more whiskey to fulfill the medicinal whiskey orders, which you could only get with a prescription from a doctor or a dentist.
Noah, what did you find in whiskey labels that had to do with suffrage and civil rights?
I mean, I think part of it is those movements affect kind of on the larger drinking scene, you know, and really one of the things to come out, I mean, obviously prohibition was a perfect storm, really, of different trends and different really forces joining together. And one of them was sort of suffragettes, you know, looking for the right to vote. And one of the things that comes out of prohibition is that for the first time ever, women are actually going to speakeasies. And like before that, women weren't drinking at saloons and bars.
No, you couldn't. Woman came into a saloon or bar.
Right. I mean, obviously.
She wasn't a lady.
Right. You know, to put it politely, and or she worked there, you know, maybe she owned it or
right.
She or her, you know, her family did or she helped run it. But really one of the things is we see women after prohibition, like finally kind of get accustomed to drinking at bars. And in fact, some of the labels and some of the bottles try to distance themselves from both the stuff sold during prohibition and maybe even before, kind of giving it more of an authentic design and maybe appealing also a little bit more to women who are now drinking.
Well, thank God prohibition ended. And there's another chapter in your book entitled Life After Temperance. So tell us how life was after temperance.
Well, it's one of these funny things. I started thinking about, well, okay, prohibition ends. Like, what happened? Like, what? Like literally, what happened that day? Like, where did the alcohol come from? And it's like, I don't know. I found some of these amazing old articles, you know, one from the Times where a reporter had gone around the city checking in to see who had alcohol, who didn't, where it was coming from. And, you know, stuff was coming from cruise ships. So one of the distributors had like an armored car that they were delivering booze around the city. One bar had to buy liquor from, quote unquote, a reliable speakeasy because the speakeasies overnight were empty. Like nobody wanted, like there was nothing novel about drinking a speakeasy anymore. Everybody, like a whole generation, had never experienced drinking in public. So everybody wanted to drink outside, you know, so the speakeasy were kind of done overnight. It was actually a pretty hard time to be a distiller and a drinker because after prohibition, just about every distillery had to be rebuilt. I mean, they had sat for so long and, you know, they had been stripped of anything they'd be stripped of, you know, metals or whatever. And all of the distillers were scrambling to get capital. A lot of them, I mean, it's not like a bank would loan you money because, you know, the stench of prohibition, you know, still haunted the industry and it did for decades. And then, you know, obviously it takes several years once you make the whiskey for it to age. So there wasn't a lot. I mean, there was stuff from Canada, you know, some of the distillers who had the foresight there to sort of start ramping up production and kind of flooded the market with Canadian whiskey. And obviously whiskey was coming from Europe where there was no real prohibition.
Thank you so much for making the time in your schedule to sit down and talk with us about the art of American whiskey.
It was my pleasure.
Noah Rothbaum, author of The Art of American Whiskey. How do you get those flaky layers in a pie crust? Stay tuned, and we'll solve that mystery when we come right back.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon here on KRVS.
Hey everybody, it's Drake with the Franco Mix on 88.7 every Thursday night at 9. N'oubliez pas, c'est formidable. Yeah, n'oubliez pas encore de écouter le Franco Mix chaque jeudi soir sur KRBS 88.7 avec Drake LeBlanc. C'est formidable.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Located 40 minutes north of New Orleans' French Quarter along the shores of Lake Pontchartrain. The North Shore's Tammany Taste features the chefs and farmers, brewers and bakers of St. Tammany Parish's culinary scene. Plan your getaway to discover the many reasons to love Louisiana North Shore at louisiananorthshore.com/10. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you get those flaky layers in a pie crust? It's all about the fat, and it's all about the chill. First, make sure the fat that's going into the crust is very cold, whether it's butter or lard. Manipulate those pieces of fat into the flour quickly using your fingertips. Sprinkle small quantities of ice water on the dough until you can just form a ball. Then wrap it in plastic and chill for at least 20 or 30 minutes before rolling. That gives the gluten strands formed by working the dough time to relax, making for a more tender crust. When you roll out a good crust, you should be able to see the streaks of fat in it. When the pie crust bakes, those cold fat layers explode between the flour, and that's what makes a pie crust flaky. My cooking teacher, Madeline Kamen, always insisted women made better pies than men because their fingers are colder. I don't know about that, but Madeline's pie crust recipe. Now, actually, she's French, so that's tart crust to her. Is simply the best ever. You'll find the recipe on our website, poppytooker.com. Now, let's hear more about pies from my friend Kate McDermott, the pie-chiatrist. Although obsessed with baking since she was a little girl, pie became a passion for Seattle's Kate McDermott in 2005. That's when she began a 2-year exploration of pie crust. Since then, Kate's been a go-to authority on the craft of pie making. Known as the pie-chiatrist, Kate shares her expertise in workshops, her books, and website. Kate joined us in the studio to help demystify the pie.
There's nothing that is hard about pie. In fact, those words, easy as pie, they really do have some truth in them. I think the biggest thing is just to believe that you can do it, not to worry about a perfect outcome, because in those little places where you have a little tear here in the crust, or you have a little... It didn't look quite like the pictures in the book. You have beauty and perfection right there in that pie.
And good taste, too, I imagine.
And memories.
Well, start us off from scratch. How do you make a pie?
I'd love to tell you that. First thing I do is I want to make sure that all my ingredients are chilled, as many as possible. So I am putting my flour in the freezer. I'm keeping my fats well chilled. My bowl comes out of the freezer too. Then I have a very, very simple recipe. It's got four ingredients for the dough. There's flour, 2.5 cups. There's salt, 1/2 teaspoon. There's the fats. I use leaf lard, 8 tablespoons of that, and 8 tablespoons of butter, and enough water to put it all together. Now, when I'm working with those fats and moving them into the flour, I'm working very, very quickly. I can do this either with my hands and just sort of smush that fat right into the flour until it looks like it's sort of coated with cracker crumbs, peas, almonds, and maybe a small walnut meat or pecan if you like that. Then I will get the water in until it's mixed enough to hold together without being sticky. And when I pull it into a ball that's about the softball size, you kind of feel, you know you're there if you can feel like you're going to pat a baby's bottom.
Well, tell me, what is leaf lard?
Leaf lard is the rendered fat from around the pig's kidneys. For generations, it is what pie makers have used for the flakiest crusts around.
Where do you get leaf lard from?
I have several places that I get it. I'm using so much leaf lard in my classes monthly. I go through 50 pounds of leaf lard in a month.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm teaching a lot. So I get it from a place in Pennsylvania, Dietrich's Meats and Country Store, and you'll love where they're in, Crumbsville, Pennsylvania.
Well, that's perfect for pie making. What do you do if the pie doesn't work out?
Uh-huh. That's happened to every pie maker around. First thing, you don't worry about it. And then you get out your lasagna pan, and you turn that pie with its beautiful ingredients into the pan, move those pie ingredients around that's baked, and it turns into the best crumble you've ever had.
That's a perfect solution. What do you do if your guests are gluten-free?
Ah, yes. Gluten-free is a big thing now, and I myself try not to eat too much gluten, but for those who can't eat it at all, you can make a gluten-free pie that's pretty darn good. I use 7 different flours, and then I just go ahead and pretty much make my dough as usual. There's a couple little tricks to it. Instead of making my dough first and chilling it, and then making my filling and then rolling out, I put my filling together first, then immediately go on to making my gluten-free dough and construct the pie and then chill it.
Ah. What are those flours?
I use several different rice flours. I use potato starch, tapioca flour, or tapioca starch. Those are just a few of the ones that I use in there.
Speaking of tapioca starch, this is something else that I really don't have any experience with. And you and I shopped for pie ingredients together, and I have to admit I was a little shocked when I saw the famous pie maker add a little red box of something that said instant on it really big to the shopping cart. What was that, Kate?
Well, that was a pie maker's best friend. That was quick cooking tapioca. When I have fillings, I call them the juicy fruit fillings. These would be rhubarb, pie cherries, berries, and frozen fruits. Those can get very, very wet inside of your pie. So I like to use quick cooking tapioca, which really sort of snugs things up. I don't want it standing up like a little soldier at the end because I like to have a certain amount of ooze in my filling, but I don't want to have fruit soup. So I will put in many times some flour, 1/3 cup, 1/4 cup of flour, and then follow that with anywhere between 1/2 teaspoon to 1.5 tablespoons of quick cooking tapioca. Now, there is another secret that you'll need to know when you're using quick cooking tapioca. And that is, you have to get the temperature high enough for the tapioca to do its work. So if you don't see enough bubbling at the end of your bake time, and I'm not talking about rapid bubble, I'm talking about some steady, even bubbling, then you can go ahead and kick your oven up for the last 5 minutes, maybe to 425, maybe to 440, until you see that, and then you're good to go.
Some pies are sort of mounded and some pies are flat. What's the deal with that?
There are two fruits that I will mound a pie with. That will be apple and pear. And those I just mound something fierce. It's not unusual for me to have a 6.5-inch tall apple pie or pear pie. They will slump down in the cooking, and their juice stays in pretty well if you've got enough thickener in there. But with those juicy fruit pies, I like to have them a little flatter. I would like to have them about 1/2 inch below the rim so we don't have any disasters.
Now, I have to ask you, what's your favorite pie?
Well, my favorite pie is always the one that I'm making. But if I had only one last pie to make, it would be a peach pie. I think that there's nothing finer than a good peach pie. And I love the Cal Red or O. Henry peaches that Frog Hollow Farms grows in California. There's nothing like those peaches.
Well, someday I'm going to have to introduce you to a Louisiana Rustin peach. And then we might change your mind just
a little
bit.
I'm ready. Anytime.
Do you have a least favorite?
Yes.
What's that?
I call it the clean the oven pie. That's the one that I think we've all had experience with at some time or the other, where you put that filling up too high in the pie and it spills over into your oven. And then you have the smoke alarm going off and the oven is just, you don't want one of those. We've all had them.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for bringing all this pie making knowledge into the studio here at Louisiana Eats. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Poppy, and be happy and make pie.
Renowned pie maker, Kate McDermott. If you're looking for more pie wisdom from the Piecatrist, check out Kate's James Beard-nominated book, The Art of the Pie. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by The Commissary, Dickie Brennan's latest venture offering complete family-style meals featuring signature dishes from Dickie's other restaurants and DIY kits for home cooking. Takeout is available Thursday through Sunday at 634 Orange Street in the Lower Garden District. You can reach them at 504-274-1850 or visit online, thecommissarynola.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.